Hello and welcome to Series 3 of Tell Dem, a podcast hosted by The Masher in partnership with Transmission Roundhouse, generously funded by the Paul Hamlin Foundation.
This series, we're shifting things around a bit, bringing you bold and unfiltered discussions around decolonising theatre.
Every episode, we'll be joined by amazing theatre makers from the global majority, discussing power structures, global influences,
what they do, how they do it, why they do it.
We're your hosts, Githika
and Beth,
and you are tuning into episode number 8. This podcast contains themes that listeners may find disturbing, triggering, or uncomfortable. Welcome, welcome.
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to the last episode of the series. We've been on quite a journey.
Yeah, it's an emotional one. I don't want it to end.
We've got a really, really brilliant conversation to end the series on. And actually, I think we only got through, like, the majority of the conversation was just off the back of one question at the start because there was so much synergy around the way that Justine Taman and Kimberly both thinking so deeply about systems and how that relates to the world around us. So we had a really brilliant conversation about that. And then we wrapped up with some advice that wasn't advice. We ended up on some mantras, some things that both Justine and Kimber carry with them and that they wanted to pass on to other theatre makers. So a nice, inspiring end to the podcast.
Welcome to episode 8, series 3 of Tell Dem. You are joined by your two hosts,
Beth Capilla
and Githika Batu. We have with us in the studio today, Justine Taman. Hi, Justine.
Hi there.
And we also have to my right on the computer, all the way from New York. How
very cool
is that?
Cool.
Kimber Lee. Hey, Kimber.
Hey.
Our furthest flung guest so far, I think. This is very exciting. What we're going to do is we're going to start off with, just some bios to let the listeners know who we have in the room with us. So first off with Justine. Justine is a theatre director and change maker who has lived or worked in Coventry since 2003. Justine was deputy artistic director at the Belgrade Theatre and in her time there set up the pioneering Black Youth Theatre and Asian Youth Theatre groups. And whilst also championing the integration of community work, talent development and the staged programme. Justine was also one of the two leadership associates at the RSC and their role was to join the RSC to think more equitably in that time emerging from the pandemic. And Justine's amazing directing work includes Coventry Moves, which also I also got the pleasure to work with Justine on that as her assistant director as part of City of Culture in Coventry. Nothello by Mojisola Adebayo and Like There's No Tomorrow, which was co-created with the Belgrade Young Company for NT Connections in 2020.
And we have Kimber Lee, who is a New York-based playwright. She was born in South Korea and raised in southwestern Idaho. She was the inaugural winner of the Bruntwood Prize International Award for Untitled Fuck Miss Saigon, which was incredible, which premiered at the Royal Exchange and at the Young Vic. Some of her writing credits include The Water Palace, Saturday, Tokyo Fish Story, and different words for the same thing. Welcome, Kimber. Shall we kick off with our first question that we ask all of the guests? And this is, what inspired you this week? I'm going to say Justine. Do you have something for us?
I do. I'm reading a book at the moment called Luckenbooth by Jenny Fagan. And I'm only in the sort of early chapters of it. But I find it really interesting because there's a character in it who's, if you like, mixed heritage, which I'm also mixed heritage, but she's mixed heritage, devil and human, and can't bear her father, who is the devil. Her mother's the human side. And the book starts with her killing her father. And later in the narrative, you see her struggle with the evil that's within her because she wants to be better than her father was. And she could murder him because of the supernatural power she has. And she decides not to because she wants to behave in a better way. And I just thought that was so beautifully articulated as the struggle that perhaps some of us face as we're trying to make change within a sort of patriarchal, capitalist, imperialist context.
That sounds so kick-ass. So what do you say into a film? That would be so good. Beth, do you have something?
Okay. So my source of inspiration recently has been turning 30. Yeah, it's just a moment to reflect, isn't it? I think a moment to think about who you are and what you're doing and why. And so it's been interesting time turning 30 and also trying to like claim my power as a 30-year-old as well.
Gorgeous. Thank you. Kimber, I'm coming to you. What inspired you this week?
There's just endless amounts for me, endless amounts of inspiration in New York City. I two things for me this week. I don't know if you all follow what's happening between Kendrick Lamar and Drake. There's been some things going on between them, but Kendrick Lamar released a video for a song that was released about a month and a half ago. And I find the video to be artistically absolutely on fire. It's kind of amazing. And the thing that I love about it is the way that it centers his community in Los Angeles. And I find that I go to a boxing gym in Harlem and I have to walk kind of almost all the way across Manhattan. And as I'm walking down 125th, it's just this beautiful expression of all of these different aspects of community. So I draw inspiration from that. I love seeing people connecting with each other. It's just a never-ending source of inspiration for me to feel people being deeply rooted and connected to community and to a place. So that's my that's my inspiration. Mm.
I can really like visualize that in my mind from that description. It's amazing.
And I think mine would be, I was in Spain a couple of weeks ago. I went with some friends. And I was saying to you, Beth, earlier that I got a new contract with my phone, which just meant that I couldn't turn my data or internet on when I was out and about. So I just left my phone in the hotel. And I just felt really present for the first time in a really long time. And we spent a lot of time by the sea on the beach, and I got to people watch and I got to be in the sun. And that was really inspiring because I was like, how much time do I give myself to just allow my mind to be completely clear? So that was quite inspiring for me.
Lovely. Well, yeah, so many like really different forms of inspiration there. And I love this question. I love this first question that we're coming to here, which is, what themes or issues do you find yourself repeatedly exploring in your work? And why are these important to you? So I'll leave it open.
You go ahead, Kimber. I started on the last one.
Okay. You know, this is a funny question for me because I don't know that when I start a piece of work that it's coming consciously from me intellectually sort of processing a theme. I think that it comes much more from an instinct, but it usually is from something that's bothering me, that it bothers my brain, it bothers my soul, it bothers my gut, you know. But again, it's like it's connected to what inspires me. It's really all about human connection, how humans are in relation to each other. And kind of, I guess if I could say anything, I've been reading a lot of Marx lately. So I'm very much thinking a lot these days about a materialist approach to things, which is observing what actually exists in the world and starting from there. And I think that my work usually follows that kind of an arc in that there is something that's happening between people in the world that kind of starts to stick to me and permeate me in a way and doesn't leave me alone. And that kind of is the irritation that begins the thing where I start to feel a need to write about it.
Do you ever find yourself looking back and going, oh, there's this thing that I didn't know at the time is like a common thread between anything?
I think it's really about human connection. I mean, there's something that I get curious about, but it's always in a very in a very human context. Like, I'm interested in what people do, and I'm interested in the way that we make sense of things. I'm interested in the way that human perception becomes a narrative. I'm interested in how all of those things fit together.
How about you, Justine? Is there something that you come back to?
Well, it's really interesting hearing you talk, Kimber, because I think in a way I have a similar process. So I've also made work about a very wide range of things, and maybe I can pinpoint those more specifically, because a lot of my work at the Belgrade, whether it was commissioning a piece from a professional writer or working co-creatively with communities, a lot of it would come from what I was hearing out in the community. Sometimes direct consultation, what do you want to make a piece of work about? Not always the best way of asking, but sometimes it yields a thing. One time I asked that a young woman from our Black Youth Theatre said, I want to make a piece of work about the impact that the HIV epidemic in Africa is having on African families in the UK. And we thought, right, that feels really exciting. So subject matter wise, very various, but I know, and I probably can't talk about it as a theme or an issue, but something that preoccupies me a lot in terms of whose stories we tell, in terms of the form of the work that that we make. There are definitely things that surface for me on a regular basis. So I would say equity and climate crisis sit underneath everything. And I kind of think, so I don't want to be reductive and say my work is only about those things, but I kind of think how can those things not be running through all of it, I think. And increasingly, climate crisis, I think. I don't know if anyone's read Amitav Ghosh, The Great Derangement. Actually, I'm looking at Beth because I know she has. He talks brilliantly about how arts and culture are at risk of failing humanity in not holding the climate crisis in everything we do at the moment, because we're hurtling towards a whole new way of living alongside, within, together with the earth. So those things are definitely in my work, and climate crisis and equity are integrally connected. And I already spoke about the story that was inspiring me this week. Yeah, we live in a world that is so dominated by hierarchies and whose stories we're allowed to tell and how we're supposed to tell them, that I think it's a challenge to that, to be constantly reinventing and rethinking how we want to tell the stories. I know there's a big piece of work that Tamasha's doing at the moment about decolonizing dramaturgy, and that feels really important to me. How do you find a form that reflects what it is you're making work about?
Yes, yeah, I totally resonate with that. And it's almost, you're talking about like the lens that you present to how you see the world and then how that's reflected in the work, which...
And then you get to that very difficult place, don't you, where we label it as eco-dramaturgy, so then it sounds like something that's separate from dramaturgy, when we're saying, actually, it needs to sit in there. That's part of the problem, is we put it into something else. But I do think it's important to name it in that way. So,
I'm very interested in all of that, because I think, as a person, I am extremely interested in systems, in studying systems and underlying structures, and following those things back to the root. It's the basis for a lot of the things that I'm studying right now and reading, trying to find the root, because I think that something that can happen a lot is that what happens for me, I'll just speak for myself, is that I can tend to get focused on a consequence, on a result of a thing that has a deep root and origin. And I am focused on the surface level embodiment of that thing and dealing with that instead of taking the time to do the necessary educating and thought processes that lead back to understanding where those things are born from. And what I find myself more and more interested in is trying to get to the root. And I'm not interested in burning it all down. I think that is an emotional reaction that is justified in some situations. But my interest, and I've gone through my phases of time where I felt like, institutions are the problem. Let's dismantle everything. But I think that just starting from that end of the stick without having actually gone to the root and really found what the root is means that the cycle gets to continue because the structures that are in place are built to sustain those circles. So I've become more interested in understanding like the root of the thing that we're trying to address. And then based on that, building out for, okay, so how would we build? Like, what are we doing? How are our actions reflecting what we know to be the root cause?
Yeah, I think it gives a really... a really clear approach and your approach to sort of the way you make work as a change maker kind of embedded in your theatre practice as an artist. And I guess our next question is related to that, I suppose, is sort of any challenges that you've encountered when advocating for better practice within theatre institutions.
And maybe I can come in because... sort of have some thoughts that very much link to what Kimber was talking about. I think one of the big challenges is I think people largely do want to do the right thing. but alongside that, I think they often don't really want to change because they have, their expertise is based on doing something a particular way. Making theatre a particular way or running a building in a particular way, leading in a particular way. And if you have to start thinking about doing it differently, that removes some of the expertise and some of the power from the people that are currently holding the expertise and the power. For me, the challenge is people say they want to make the change, but I'm not sure that they really do, and sometimes don't really know that they don't want to.
So
I think that links with what you're saying, Kimber, in that how do we... Because I think what the result of that is that representation is getting better in the industry, no question, but often we're let in if we know how to do the thing that's already happening well, because we can be graded on the existing system. But actually thinking about how we do things differently, I think is a real challenge to the sector. And that's the thing that I find most frustrating. And I think, I think all of us, if you have lived experience that's out of the mainstream, you certainly bring another perspective. But there's also a lot of pressure on us. And I suppose I speak with a degree of privilege. I'm fairly middle class. I started off youth theatre at the Roundhouse. lived in Camden probably when it was, on the up. I have a degree of privilege that I can, to an extent, hold my own within the existing system. But I think there's a lot of pressure that once, if you're outside the system and being let in, there's a lot of pressure to behave as the system expects you to behave so that you get to stay in and don't get booted out again. So that for me is the real sort of paradox of change at the moment.
I think about these things all the time. They occupy so much of my brain space. And I think you cannot but think about these things even in an unconscious way. Like when you walk into our most powerful theater institutions, as a person who is not white, you will always be having thoughts running. It's like one of those background programs running on your laptop. You have to have that running the whole time that you're in there because you're aware of being in a place that was not built for you to be in it. It was not meant for you to be there. that system has a rigidity that it cannot, even if the people within it are trying to do the right thing, the system does not allow for it because it is built this way, even down to the practicalities of like, and I'm sure, Justine, you know this from having worked in an institution for so long, it's like the machine has to run this way because this is when the people need to get paid. This is when the carpenters and the scene shop painter, you know, like it has to run on a schedule because it is so much going on. The production model kind of is what it is. It doesn't have that much give. I had a production in 2021 out on the West Coast, and they were trying to respond to a lot of the upheaval that happened in 2020 around George Floyd's murder and, of course, the legacy reaching far, far back, hundreds of years from that particular event. But they were trying to institute a limit on tech hours because 10 out of 12, which we'd overhear, were seen as being, you know, unjust to, you know, the theater workers. They were cutting back on the 10 out of 12s, but they weren't extending the time at all. So essentially it was saying like, you have to deliver the show in a significantly less amount of time. Again, ideas of making things more just, making things more equitable that are dealing with problems that we can see above the surface and that do not address the structural issues will, for me, it will end up being that kind of wonky thing where it's a laudable attempt, but it's not really getting at the root of it. And it can't because this system does not allow for it.
But isn't that what the change needs to be? So I would say one of the major issues is that we consider our relationship with people in a very segregated way. So the marketing teams are responsible for engaging with audiences, and the community and education teams are responsible for dealing with communities, and the artistic directors are responsible for dealing with artists, as if those weren't all people within a community. So there's a quite a transactional relationship. It's not even focused on relationship. It's focused on transaction rather than on how do we have a relationship with the people that live in our city more broadly, because we are in public service. I think artists like to think that they're, or artistic organisations, perhaps not artists, like to think that that arts is in some way removed or elevated from the people that we serve. But fundamentally, we are only our audiences and artists and communities. So I think there's something there in what that relationship is. How do we, instead of doing two, how do we engage in dialogue with the people in our city and everybody, so that it's not somebody top down making the, you know, deciding what the program is, what the production schedule is, but there's a much more sort of consultative process involved in how the organization is led. So I think it's in leadership structures, right from artistic leadership. How does an artistic leader, instead of imposing a sort of single authorial voice, how do they engage with a range of artists, with a range of the communities in the city in order to shape a program? And then in shaping that program, how already if you're shaping it that way, you're shaping something that people feel connected to. So how do you then grow that into your production process and into your communications process, so that the production process suits each piece of work that's being evolved? And I think there does need to be a degree of system, but I don't think it needs to be the system that we have now, that is very much sort of, okay, and the next one, and the next one, and the next one. It needs to be conceived of much more holistically rather than episodically, I think.
Yeah, I agree in all of that. People are sometimes surprised from working with me as a playwright, because I like to I like to know about everything that's happening related to my show because I carry a sense of responsibility for a piece of work that I put out into the world. So I care very much how it's being marketed. I care very much about how the community that I am hoping to uplift is being marketed to and communicated with by whatever theater is producing my work, and how that theater situates in the community. And I guess it comes down also to a sense of mission, because it's not like every theater needs to operate in the same way as well. I know that in terms of leadership, there's all kinds of questions around, you know, having a leader who is also an artist or having a leader who is primarily focused on infrastructure and, you know, fundraising and all of the mechanisms that need to be tended to for the theater to run. All kinds of questions about that and how that affects the theater's sense of mission. But I agree with you. I think that we get into silos, but that is the effect of capitalism, is to separate everybody into their singular, very limited function and be like, just do that one thing so that we can have this product at the end.
You kind of took
Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I was going to say, you kind of took the words out of my mouth. I was going to say, that's because we live in a capitalist, or theatre is being increasingly commodified by a capitalist system. So the value that we place on it, even, you know, we talk about marketing the show, it's because we want to sell tickets, and a show is successful if it gets large audiences. So it's we're losing a sense of what theatre was and is and could be in helping us to understand who we are.
I'm curious too, because y'all in the UK have had in the past a much more supported arts sector in terms of subsidies and things like that, like than we have over here. And I'm curious if any of you can talk a little bit about that trajectory and how you've seen it affecting the art that is made.
I'm finding, and I'm speaking to something that you mentioned earlier, Kimber, about speaking from the perspective of as a director. I've been directing theatre for the last 9 years. And I feel like resource is just getting tighter and tighter. And that thing about, you know, you were talking about tech days or rehearsal processes being shortened and shortened. Like when I first started in I can speak for the regions mainly, that's where I make work. I make stuff in London, but mainly in the regions and in the north. And it was sort of like 5-6 weeks worth of rehearsal processes that I was used to either assisting on or making. And now, like, it's a standard that when I'm getting offered shows for theatres, it's 3 weeks. And it used to be like, oh, can you do this in 3 weeks? Because we're just a bit tight on budget, blah, 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 blah. And it was kind of like, oh, well, I'll do it this one time because I understand that you guys are, you know, blah, blah. And it's almost like a favour thing that's being done. But then what happens then is I can't make the work that I want to make and collaborate properly in the room because I'm always on the back foot. I'm always like, right, and I'm basically a week behind already. So when we begin, as much as I want to dismantle what it means to be a director and really not sit there as a leader but a facilitator for collaboration in the room, I find that so hard to do because I just don't think 3 weeks is long enough. So, I mean, that's one of the strands, but that's something that I've noticed as a maker over a period of time in this country, is that because things are crunching, numbers get crunched, structures get crunched, and that means that our art has to get crunched at the same time. And that's quite soul-destroying to be in a room being like, I'm always on the back foot. I can never feel inspired or have the space and time to think.
I say, I think there's something really, just in answer to your question, there's something really radical in the sector in the UK at the moment. But it's interesting how it's mitigating, I think, for current context. But the Arts Council 10-year strategy, Let's Create, I think, and it's not necessarily that fashionable to say so, I think, but I think it's a hugely radical strategy. And it is trying to think differently about the integration, I think, of communities, audiences, artists, and allowing a spectrum of work to exist, but work that interplays with each other. But I think it's not popular. I think people see it as watering down the art, as not placing quality central enough, quality in inverted commas, central enough to output. So there's quite a tension, I think, in the UK at the moment between this 10-year strategy and, yeah, again, very interesting to see what can happen to that now with a new government. We're in that sense, we're in a very different place, I think, in terms of the role that the Arts Council holds moving forward. But it does sit in tension at the moment. It is the underlying strategy for arts funding in this country for 10 years, but there are a lot of people who don't like it, and who there are people that are paying lip service to it. And it's leading to things that look like they're progressive and making change and aren't, as well as to a lot of really good things that are happening. I'm really aware I'm talking quite challenging the status quo and the hegemony. There's a lot of really great stuff that's happening too that is seeking to challenge those structures that you were talking about, Kimber.
Yeah, I think it's I think it's as you say, it's quite a contentious one, because it's, I agree, I think it's really important that there's a strategy that does prioritise like making work with community, but then I think what's happening is the work that doesn't, just because it that process doesn't maybe hold that or necessitate that, then are just adding it on top, and it becomes actually way more harmful, I think, than if that project or that show didn't have that sort of, what's the word, superficial engagement, like no engagement, I think, in like that community engagement, almost in some of those contexts, is better than the superficial drop in, drop out.
And I think what you're saying, Beth, is that it can, you can have a spectrum of work. Not everything has to be co-created. I think that's really important. But if we thought broadly about what co-creation was, what if it was in some way? What if we spoke to audiences, or communities, or artists, in a way that meant everything, that informed everything that we did? So you can still go off and do a piece of work that ostensibly is artists in a room creating something that, you know, as you've spoken about, is inspired by the world that they've seen. I don't think there's an issue with that. But what if there was engagement that connected with that, that meant that different people might be coming to see it than we might get if we just put it on a stage and marketed it? So there's that tension as well, I think, that people feel the need to make a differentiation between something that is and isn't co-created. And I think it's much more fluid and much more exciting and much more creative than it's often presented.
I guess there's a lot of layers to this question. Like, because my question is about, what is your definition of why theater is not... why is theater necessary? I'm not sure that I'm a fan of that, like, why this, why now question, because it feels very limiting. But I am interested in how people in their own lives think about, hold in their heart, and then, you know, reflect in their actions what they believe about the necessity of theater. Trying to go back to this idea of, like, what are we saying when we're saying that theater is the lifeblood of a culture, that it is necessity, that it can be the lifeblood of a community? What are we saying? What does that mean? And who says it and really has an active, alive relationship to that question that's driving what they're doing? And who is saying that because it sounds good at the awards luncheon?
That's such a useful question. You said so many things that feel so interesting and exciting. I love that thing about what's the alternative way? What can theatre mean? And there are a few things for me. So I worked at the Belgrade for 18 years, and I suppose what I was trying to do And it's not that I knew everything that I was trying to do at the beginning. It was trying to hear where things were and what we needed to do to move forward and grow something differently. And so I started off leading the youth and community work. Always felt that it was problematic that that was set up in a binary with the professional work. But that was the structure that was in that place. So that's the role I took on. But over time, as Beth said, we set up this Black Youth Theatre and an Asian Youth Theatre, which doesn't sound particularly radical, perhaps. It's a youth theatre. But to other people, sounded very radical, I think, at the time. There was quite a lot of opposition to it, that it was seen as separatist, racist even. But actually what it did over time was build, I can use the word critical mass, because we also set up a programme in partnership with the Royal Court called Critical Mass, which was about working with Black and Asian writers emerging. And over time, so, you know, that's 18 years that I was there, it has built a critical mass of artists in Coventry and the wider region. In fact, people were coming from the wider region to Coventry because of its reputation, not just for working more diversely, although some people came because we were working more diversely, but also because we were working differently. And it started to, you know, I think it was the Arts Council brought in, is it Creative Case for Diversity? Mm-hmm. About 10, 12 years ago. And we were already doing it. We were already engaging with communities at grassroots level, making work with them, quality youth theatre work, work from new writers, bringing those audiences in because we already had relationships with them through the youth theatre work and the other community-rooted work that we had. So all that work was starting to impact work on our stages. So what we, there were three of us that were co-artistic directors for our City of Culture year, and we really tried to do a pilot year in which those things were all part of our thinking as we shaped a programme. And as Beth said, that, you know, the vision for the theatre moving forward is rooted in that, is rooted in that sort of co-creative ethos in a range of different ways. So I think it is possible for theatre to be something different, for, you know, to be the space that a lot of the kids would talk about it as their home, their second home, for some of them their home. And parents started to come in, and it felt like it was a space that that did belong to people. And when we put on, I think the first piece of work that came out of the Critical Mass programme was called Red Snapper by a writer called Liz Mitten, which was about Jamaican independence. And when we were first sort of pushing to put that on, people go, oh, well, we don't have enough, big enough Black community to come and see that show. But what felt really clear as we started to programme more of those pieces of work is that people want to be a part of that journey. It's not just Black people that want to come and see that show. They want to be part of the change that means we're being more mutually understanding of each other, both in our city and in narratives across the world. So I suppose I believe passionately that it is possible to do it differently, but it does take time and it does take responsiveness and listening and a different kind of leadership in order to get us there. And I think at the moment, financial constraints mean that a lot of theatres are having to backtrack on some of the good practice that was and is starting to emerge.
Yeah, and there's a non-theatre example that I've come across recently in terms of what you were talking about, Kimber. Nabil Al-Kanani, who has written a book called Privatise the Mandem, which is basically talking about if you privatise the council estate and it's owned by the people who live there, then you are able to say you cannot, like the police cannot enter when they want. And so by privatising something, by using capitalism against capitalism, and by saying, well, we own this and we have the power now, so we can create the rules, which I, again, has been quite a controversial thing from what he was, from when he's talking about it from within his the circles that he's working in. He says that it's been quite a controversial idea for people, but I think it speaks a lot of what you were talking about, like amassing power.
Is the private ownership some sort of cooperative based where the residents kind of cooperatively own the buildings?
I don't know the details of that sort of that governance structure. I'm not 100% sure, but I think it's just that I think it, at the moment it's more the idea and how you can use that as an idea. I don't know how, I'm not sure how it works in practice, but I think there's maybe one last question that we're going to come to.
About advice.
Yeah, I think it's really nice to sort of round up maybe on a piece of advice that you would give to a theatre maker from the global majority about navigating the creative process whilst also navigating an industry that is predominantly white. And I suppose, Kimber, you could maybe talk about sort of from your perspective in the States, and that would be really interesting.
I feel very cautious about giving advice because I think no matter how well meant it is a thing that can have a disproportionate amount of power in someone's life. And the things that I know from having traversed the things that I have and in my life are very particular to me and my circumstances and may or may not be helpful to someone else. So in lieu of advice, what I would say to people, and what I do say to people who come to me, is I first of all can be a listening ear and a support. But what I say to people is kind of a version of something that James Baldwin said to writers, younger writers, who were asking him for advice, which is just basically, what you need to know is that the struggle is real, and that if your mind is made up about it, no one is going to hand it to you. No one's going to give it to you. However, if your mind is made up, no one can stop you. So, and there's also a boxer that I admire, a fighter named Andre Ward, who was a great champion before he retired. And he said once in an interview, like, a made up mind is a very powerful thing. So that's what I would say to somebody. Like, it's not going to be easy. It's going to be full of obstacles and pitfalls and all of that. But if your mind is made up, then you must be undeniable. You must be unstoppable. And you can.
So interesting. Inspiring. Yeah. Yeah, mine's very related to that. The first thing I think of is that you need to hold your centre, which I think connects quite a lot with your sense of your mind is made up, because you will be buffeted from all sides and you just got to hold strong in the centre, because if that gives in, then you can be swept away. But the other part of it is, somebody said to me right at the beginning of my career when I was working at Dundee Rep as a drama worker, start from where you're at and not from where you thought you'd be. And I find that, so maybe it's useful to think of them as mantras rather than advice in some way. When I'm in a place of despair sometimes or rage, that's the thing that anchors me, because you are where you are. So, given that you're here, what do you do next? So there's that interesting sense of holding strong and remaining responsive to the world that you're encountering.
I love that. I love that.
Brilliant. Well, thank you both so much for being with us today. We've really got into systems and structures. So thank you so much. And thank you, everybody at home, for listening. So that's it. That's the end of series three.
I'm sad.
We've had some amazing guests.
Unreal. I feel so lucky to have shared space with so many incredible people and so many inspiring artists.
It's been a real, real privilege. And thank you, everyone who's listened and been part of these conversations. I think that's what's important, that these conversations carry on.
Absolutely. And hopefully we will be back with you soon for a new series. So do stay tuned and check out the Demacher website.
Bye.
Bye. Shout out to me.
If you love this episode, then please do share it with your friends and maybe even leave a cheeky review.
And for more of Tell Them, don't forget to subscribe and follow us on our socials for episode drops.